everybody. Good morning. It is Shelly, Steve, Christy, and Jason here with you to pick on another real estate topic. And this is a big one that comes up a lot, and that is the rent to own. So how are you guys doing this morning?
Excellent.
Excellent. Thank you. Excellent.
So what a lot of times happens is either I have a listing that I put on the market or somebody goes on Zillow or Trulia or, you know, they're not working with a realtor at that point. And they call the listing agent and ask if the person's interested in doing a rent to own. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One big one is they're not quite able to get a loan yet. Maybe they've gone through a divorce, they filed a bankruptcy. You know, Jason can hit on that a little bit more. But their goal is to own a home. They like the home that's listed. They're just not in a position to purchase it yet. And we just want to go over some of the pitfalls of what happens when people can do rent to owns, just to make you a little bit more aware of it. So the first thing that I would do is I put them in contact with somebody like Jason and say, Jason, they can't get a loan just yet. Is this somebody who's on track to get one? You know, what type of conversation would you then have with the person? What would you be looking for to help out a possible rent to own situation?
I guess in my world, there's a lot of different situations or circumstances that would come into play that would, you know, in their mind warrant the need for that. But first and foremost, it would probably be just credit issues, you know, like people that have maybe made some mistakes in the past and trying to rebuild their credit. The conversations they have with me are great because a lot of times people don't know, like, what do I need to do? So when I have a conversation with them, I'll look at it and be like, okay, here's where you stand. And sometimes it's very simple things like, hey, you've got too many revolving credit cards with high balances versus limit. There's, you know, maybe some, medical collections or things like that. So we'll run them through a simulator. And oftentimes we can give them a decent timeline, like, hey, if you follow this plan, you should be in a position to put yourself in a position to buy, you know, an XYZ time frame. Then there's other situations that, you know, people discuss rent to own with me where, like, maybe they're going through a divorce or something. And in our world, if somebody's newly divorced and say one of the partners is getting alimony or child support, well, in the banking world, they have to have that for a certain amount of time and show that it's consistently been paid in order for it to be eligible. So that may be another reason people look to enter into a lease to own, rent to own situation. Things like that.
The time frame that you mentioned is huge from, you know, our standpoint. Is, let's say, in the situation I had, it was probably like 2 years if she stayed on track, right? And then that lets the seller or the potential landlord know how long it would be for that, you know, that rent to own period to happen. And that's huge, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've had situations where I've talked to an actual landlord, property owner, and even a real estate agent like yourself trying to put a transaction together. But hey, listen, in my professional opinion, this person is sitting here, and if they follow these steps, then it looks like they will be able to get financed. And I've even put that in an email to give assurances to say, hey, you know, obviously the ball's in the consumer's court to follow these steps, but this is my opinion of it. And here's where I think that what the end game is. So I've done things like that to help folks out.
No, that's part. I mean, at the end of the day, even in a regular transaction that's supposed to be 60 days, you know, you've worked with people who went and bought co-signed for a car, things happen in life. You throw out 2 years, a lot more things can happen. So it's scary in that regard, but you at least want to make sure the person's on track, right? Like they've been doing what they've, the best that they can to bring that credit score down, to close up things. It's just, everybody can have the best intentions, but, you know, life also, you have to keep your job, right? Job history has to come into play, those types of things. So let's say that you feel warm and fuzzy that the person's going to be able to get financed and that piece is going to happen. Now it comes down to the property itself. And Dave wasn't able to be with us this morning, but I did send him a text as far as a home inspection. When does that take place? Maybe Christy has a little bit more information on that when I get to her about some legalities of it. But, you know, you're going into a home. If you were purchasing it, you'd probably want to have that home inspection to see what's the age of everything. And, you know, from a seller standpoint, you know, they're hoping to sell it and be done with it. If it's a rent to own, who's responsible for those types of things? So when we get to Christy, we'll maybe touch on the home inspection piece a little bit. But Dave said he had done a couple of those. He doesn't know what happens afterwards because, as you know, the home inspectors, they don't negotiate the pieces. But they, you can get one if you're looking to do a rent to own. You can get that.
One of the things and Christy will probably touch on this too, but when I'm talking to someone about, you know, them entering into an agreement like that, like a rent to own or a lease to own, there's so many things that can trip them up. But the first thing that I tell them is that you need to contact an attorney, because if you're going to do this, you have to make sure that whatever you're entering into is legal, and that you know that you're not going to get taken advantage of, and something's not going to, you know, they're not just going to pull the rug under you. Now, I think Christy had mentioned before, is that there's people that will write these type of agreements up on documents that aren't really supposed to be written up, that, you know, to cover that type of transaction. So, and then in the banking world, you know, I'll see people that will come to me later and be like, yeah, okay, so I gave a deposit up front of $3,000, and then I paid $1,200 a month in rent, but $200 of that rent is now going towards my down payment and closing costs and all these things that they never checked with a banker to see if that was acceptable or if they could use it or what the protocol was to use that. You know, it's sometimes people don't think about those things. So if somebody were to consider it, they really need to involve just like they were buying a home, because essentially that's what they're trying to do, but they're delaying it. So they need to involve the people that know the industry to help guide them the right way.
You know, I never thought about that piece of it, Jay, and that is because you're right. There's usually a large deposit, right? Instead of just a regular security deposit. If you've ever thought about doing this, you've ever been through it, sometimes it can be up to $5,000 or $10,000, depending on the purchase price. And then you pay, let's say that your rent is $1,500 a month, $200 of it goes to the purchase price. So, and again, it might be better for Christy, but if you used a regular lease that you find online, that's not going to be laid out there for you. You know, you definitely want to have some strong language in there that makes sure everybody knows where the money's going. I didn't realize that technically might not be able to be used for the finance piece of it that, you know, that you were just talking about. So that's kind of interesting to hear.
It does. Yeah. And then like the deposit, I've had to go back to someone and say, I need you to go back 2 years and give me your bank statements to show that money actually came from you and cleared your account. And well, it seems kind of trivial, but, you know, it's a deposit. You have to prove that you paid it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a heck of a point too. There's all these pieces. That's why I love this group so much, because there's all these little pieces that line up that nobody thinks about how they play out to others. So we're going to skip over to Steve real quick, because the other little piece of that has to do with insurance. There's a difference, which we've talked about before, with pre and post possession. But now you're talking about a true rental situation where somebody's looking to purchase later, but the insurance still has to be separate, right? Like it's a renter's policy, or how would that work, Steve?
Yeah, so there's two components. I guess it depends on like how this rental property came to be. So if let's say, for example, it was a seller who decided the market isn't right, I'm going to rent it out instead. This person wants to buy it. So that's fine. We'll transition to, you know, rent to own, lease to own sort of deal. So they do that, but they don't change their own policy from a homeowner's policy to a landlord's policy. Well, that's a problem. So first step is, even though you didn't technically sell the house, but now you've changed over and you're actually renting it to someone else, you still need to make a move with the insurance policy. Rather than canceling it now, you have to have it canceled and rewritten. So that's step one from the seller's perspective. Make sure that the policy is written appropriately to be the proper type of language to respond in the event that there's a loss. So that has to transition. So that's number one. Number two is the tenant. So the tenant is only going to get a policy to cover their liability and their personal belongings up to the extent that they wish to cover them. So the landlord is not responsible for any of the renter's stuff, as they wouldn't be in any other sort of situation, lease to own or not. But I think a lot of times what happens is you get folks who are the owners or the sellers, I should say, landlords, who are beginning to sort of mentally check out of the fact that they still own this place. And because they've now given it over to someone else who is the sort of quasi owner or owner to be, they allow them to start making changes, sometimes cosmetic, sometimes more than that. And while doing so, anything that would eventually potentially lead to a loss, meaning like to the property itself, the house, the structure, the detached garage, pool, fence, etc., that still falls back to the owner. The tenant is not insured. The tenant has no insurable interest on the actual property itself. And there's two ways to spin that. One, if there's a bank involved in terms of like there's already a loan on the property that the seller is making payments to, well, they're actually going to come first anyway. So on the mortgagee clause, they're the lost payee. That house comes down to the ground, they're getting paid first. So the money comes there, they get squared, number one, and then anything left over at that point would go, you know, obviously onto to the landlord or to the actual owner of the property. But the tenant themselves is sort of like out of luck regardless. I mean, they have no negotiating power over any of it. And I mean, I suppose you could get down into some contract language to figure out some legality element of it. But from what I've seen in the past, there's very little recourse that the tenant would have in terms of like recouping any of their expenses that they may have put into the property along the way. There are some endorsements that a tenant can put onto the policy, which I would recommend. It's called tenants improvements and betterments, which usually is capped at a certain dollar amount, but there are some carriers who have some flexibility to that. So in the event that there was a loss, they at least would have some recourse to get back some of what they put into it financially. You know, maybe it's flooring, maybe it's light fixtures, things like that. Stuff like beyond paint and superficial sort of updates. But that's one way to actually get something. And then of course, you know, you have a loss of use element to it. So if they're displaced as a result of the loss, the tenant can have coverage to live elsewhere built into the renter's policy that may cover them for, you know, a year or a certain dollar amount, whichever comes first. And another reason why the seller wants to make sure that they've rewritten this into a landlord's policy is because now what would otherwise have also been loss of use for the homeowner, well, they have another place to live. So if the house that they were renting out, you know, is not habitable because of a loss, well, they don't have anything to collect on a home policy. So on a landlord's policy, loss of use translates now to loss of rents. So whatever they were getting in rent now, they can now get back out of the insurance policy. So again, they're properly protected and they can have some actual, you know, recourse within the policy to get reimbursed for any loss of income that they were going to that they could have received due to the person who was renting the house coming out. But sometimes I think, and again, I think this is probably the biggest thing to be concerned of, if you're in this agreement from an insurance perspective, the tenant needs to understand and the seller needs to understand that this has not changed hands yet. So the seller is still responsible both for the structure and they are second in line for liability. So my recommendation to any seller is to make it part of the contract that the tenant, because they're still a tenant, is getting a renter's policy and that the landlord is listed as an additional insured with special notice of cancellation. This way, if day three, they say, all right, yeah, I showed them proof, I'm gonna cancel it, get my, you know, $175 back and call it a day. If the tenant were to do that, the landlord would be sent a letter letting them know, hey, this policy is canceled, FYI, all right? So then the landlord can make sure that both the renter's policy is there and that the liability is now going to answer first before they're going to be liable. Doesn't mean they're not going to be liable. It'll eventually come to them if the issue that occurred was big enough, but it at least give some buffer on the tenant's policy to answer first. So tenant has somebody over to visit, their dog bites another kid, let's say, massive loss, you know, physical deformity to the face, whatever, it's healed, but it'll never be the same. You can, that's a blank check oftentimes situation. So landlord says, oh crap, okay, well, I own the property, I'm ultimately liable here, but the tenant's policy would answer first. So I would say, you know, get at least $500,000 in liability that on the tenant's policy, first and foremost, not very expensive. You're talking a difference of maybe $20 a year between 300 and 500. It's worth it. Go higher if you want to, but I would at least have that be the floor and have that in place and be listed so that you can be told if something, you know, got canceled or was non-renewed or for whatever reason. And then that way the owner of the property is kept informed. So those are, I mean, that's a lot of information packed into a very short period of time. I can elaborate further on that in the future, but yeah, there's a lot going on there and oftentimes the most overlooked component of this entire process.
Well, it is. And we've talked about that in other parts of the real estate transaction. Insurance always comes in last in some people's mind, but it's this huge piece of it. So both Jason and Steve had touched on the fact that attorneys almost, you almost need them from the get-go, right, Christy? Because from the first thing that gets signed, what's all being included in that agreement? And both Steve and Jason mentioned things that I wasn't even aware of. I never thought about the fact that if a tenant does put improvements in, let's say that I brought the buyer to the situation and the landlord says, yeah, change out the flooring, take down a wall, open the room so you have you know, more of an open floor plan. The house is going to be yours. Do what you want to it. There's two sides to that. One is, did they have it done professionally? Because if they move out and it was a cob job, now the seller has, you know, loss of value to their home. And if they did an amazing job and it falls apart, now the buyer just put a lot of money into a house that the seller is going to benefit from. So I never really thought about it from that standpoint of, you know, how much are you going to be putting in? And like I mentioned before we went live, you know, I'm a lot longer into the business. So I've seen a lot more since the first time I've done one, but it has been interesting all the different ways things can go wrong. So with that being said, let's go over to Christy from the legal side of it, because she has probably seen more than any of us combined when it comes to these rent to owns. So
yeah,
how you start, Christy?
They're highly not recommended for mostly all of those reasons, right? And then a few others. So you've got the side of people want to do improvements, right? I'm going to live here. It's going to be mine. I'm going to do all of these things. In our normal contract, it would be you can't do improvements unless the landlord says that you can. And even then, it's at your own risk too, right? Because you don't get that money back. So you want to dump in $20,000, $30,000 into this house that you think you're going to own someday. That's up to you. But the risk is that it burns down or they don't close because the seller runs away to the Caribbean and you never see them again. So you can't get that deed when we finally get to the end and everything is ready to go. Everybody's behaved accordingly up until right now. So there's a bunch of ways it can go sideways. The mortgage being on it is another thing, right? Because technically your landlord's in breach of their mortgage. The odds that the bank's going to come out and say, hey, we're going to accelerate your loan and foreclose. Not great. So assuming, right, that the landlord is paying his mortgage or her mortgage, which could also be a thing, right? They can decide, I'm not going to pay it. I'm just going to stick in my pocket and go away and see you later. And then you end up getting foreclosed on by a bank that you didn't really know existed because you just entered into this rent to own thing with the guy who or gal that you've known forever. And they're a nice person because they grew up with your parents and, you know, they're like your uncle, whatever. Everything's fine.
I just want to say real quick, Christy, that has happened twice in the years I've been doing this, where the mortgage is the owner of the property just quit paying the mortgage, pocketed it. And then the person who thought they were buying a house, the bank foreclosed on it. So that is a real thing for anybody that thinks people wouldn't do that to you. They really do. It's scary. Yeah.
And because to your point, sellers have kind of checked out though how they decide they don't want to pay their mortgage anymore, because that will have an impact on you as the landlord/seller, right? Ultimately. So you don't just get away scot-free in that case. But traditionally in our contracts where people have said, we're doing this, right? Because at the end of the day, they come and say, we're going to do a rent to own. We go, well, man, not a great idea for all of these reasons that we'll go through on each side. But our standard says, hey, look, we're renting, landlord-tenant relationship right now, very traditional lease. When we get to a point where you want to exercise your right to buy, your rent payments will be, you know, put onto your purchase price. If you're buying for $100,000 and you've lived there for 2 years at $1,000 a month, it's $24,000 that comes off your purchase price because you've already quote unquote paid it. And then at that point, we will then enter into a very standard real estate contract, the same form that we all see here in Onondaga County or whichever form the real estate agents use. And that's where all of it then starts from the purchase perspective. You basically end up with the right to buy it, and you can exercise that right as of a date certain. And then we go into purchase mode, right? Where all of us would be very comfortable knowing what's about to happen or what's not about to happen as things normally go. That's how we like to see it, because we know what's about to happen, right? We then get our inspection rights potentially. And we lay all that out in the initial contract, right? We're going to enter into a standard form contract. We're going to get financing. We're going to get a home inspection. We're going to do all these things. As for the financing piece, you know, Jay mentioned that there might be some hiccups in there, which I don't specifically deal with, because at the end of the day, it's on them to get financed, right? And if they can, they can. And if they can't, then they walk away. They have to leave and potentially leave all those beautiful improvements that they put in thinking everything would be fine. But that's the not the worst case scenario of all the scenarios that this could possibly end in. So buyer side problem is ultimately that the seller might run away and you never get all that back. And then we have to sue, right? And that's not a cheap proposition. We could sue and probably win and ultimately get the house into the tenant slash buyer's name, but it would be a long process and it would be expensive. So there are other theoretical ways you could have your seller sign a deed in advance, way in advance. This is years. And somebody holds it in escrow, their attorney maybe, until we get to that point and everybody has got their money, the buyer's done everything they should, and then the seller's attorney releases it. But that's assuming, one, that they go for that, which is not ideal, right? Because once that original deed is kicking around, nobody knows what's going to happen to it. Two, that attorney's still around, because yeah, that may not be a thing. And then, so tracking that down, they're not going to let me hold it as representing the buyer. We have those two issues. And in addition to all of the things with the buyer potentially not getting financed and all of that good stuff, that's worst case scenario on the buyer side. On the seller side, the worst case scenario is your buyer tears the place up, won't leave, doesn't close, all of it. So in all cases, you end up in court for a seller, right? I'm either in landlord-tenant court, which still, we're still on the moratorium for the next, what's today, the 16th? For another 15 days, technically speaking. I'll see if it gets extended. You can't get anybody out. It's impossible. Even if it's not a COVID hardship. So even if these people can pay and they've been paying along, they just aren't complying with the lease, you still can't get them out. A lot of sheriffs are saying, thanks, that's nice. COVID, not going to do it. So you have that piece of it, right? And then, you know, who knows what else happens? They may not close, then you still have to get them out. It's not good.
Well, you know, rent to own is kind of like the same way people always say, I didn't marry the person thinking I'm going to get divorced. Sellers and buyers, landlords and tenants, they don't go into that agreement thinking it's going to go south, right? It's all in the beginning. Everybody's getting along, you know, and there's other pieces that we've talked about. If a refrigerator breaks or a stove or, you know, a furnace, right? If you're not invested in the house anymore, if you're the seller, you're the landlord, you're not vested, you don't really want to put a top of the line furnace in. You don't want to put, you know, the $2,000 refrigerator in. So it's all these little things that if they're not laid out in the beginning, they become tense moments throughout the process.
Yep.
So sometimes we end up having those conversations, even though we don't, you know, we don't write the legal pieces of it, but we will say, well, if the refrigerator goes, who's responsible for replacing it? Or maybe the landlord says, I'll give $700 towards a new refrigerator. If you want anything over that, you have to come up with the additional. There's all these little things that come up that people don't think about, because in the beginning, it's all about, I'm going to sell my house. You're going to buy it in 2 years. I love your house. I can't wait to buy it. But it becomes all like a lot of pieces of friction, because the tenant, to Steve's point, when he was talking about wanting to do improvements, they're looking at it as their home. And the seller's looking at is a home I want to get rid of, right? Mm-hmm. And I just, in my world, that's where a lot of the friction, the phone calls I get 2 years later, you know, or a year and a half later. Hey, we're so close to closing. This happened. What do you think I should do? And it's that, you know, at that point, I'm still kind of working with them, but it makes everybody's life easier from the very beginning. To Jason's point, if the lender, the attorney, the insurance person, the real estate agents, whether there's one or two, everybody has as much detail laid out in the beginning, because then there's less room for confusion as the process goes on. Right.
Yeah. Yep. And yep. It's even generally speaking, I still don't recommend it, because you have a landlord tenant relationship. Most people are not built to be landlords. They weren't built to be landlords pre all of the revisions to the landlord tenant law. And they're definitely not built to be landlords now. And it's even without COVID, it's still very difficult to get people out. So I don't recommend it from that space, especially because most of the time these are longer terms, right? We're talking a year to at least a year, if not more, two, five, some times even, because again, these people have to build their credit. That takes time. Who knows what? So getting somebody out who's been there for over 2 years, you have to give them 90 days. That's a long time. To say you have to get out, and then again, Lord only knows what they do in the interim, potentially, which, you know, worst case, hopefully they just go quietly and say thank you very much. But, you know, they people do all sorts of terrible things when they're angry and upset. And then it's your problem to fix as a seller. And you've already kind of mentally checked out too, right? Maybe you're living in Florida because you've retired and you're just not here, but now you've got to come back to a place where they've, you know, cut the HVAC tubing all down and broken a bunch of stuff and just left it in complete disrepair. So you have to fix all that.
Yeah, and if you're a tenant, you want to really triple check this contract and this agreement, because, you know, once upon a time it was January 2020 and we were heading at our normal 3-4% annual increase, and then all of a sudden we went into like full like jet fuel, rocket fuel, like explosion in value. And 18 months later, if you're a landlord and you're sitting there and you're like, please blink, because I want you out and I'm going to sell this thing for about 80 grand more than what I negotiated with you. And you're sitting in there and you have nothing of significance to hold on to be able to plead your case when they go to try to pull that on you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to be able to get out from, you want to prevent that from happening in any possible way that you can.
Right. Or on the flip side, let's say 2 years passes and you agreed to pay $100,000 and the market's tanked and now it's worth 80. Now what?
Great point. Great right. point. Absolutely. Yeah. It won't appraise now. Now what? Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Residential housing transaction is about the here and now. How you like stretch that out over anything more than maybe 6 months at best is really challenging, I feel like.
And that is a question. You know, people say, well, how do I know what the house is going to be worth in 2 years? And our answer is we don't have a crystal ball, regardless if it's rent to own or somebody calls and says, I think I'm selling now. Should I wait 2 years? You know, it really is. I think, Jay, I think for the appraisal, don't they go about 6 months back and they take a look? And if you have to go back further, you can, but they always say market trends last about six months on average.
So. Yeah, 6 months to a year, roughly. But yeah, the more fresh the date, the better.
Yeah. Well, it's not all gloom and doom. There are occasionally where it works out, but I unfortunately don't have one of those stories to share. Looking at anybody else if they have a happy ending story to share, but you know, sometimes this sweet little lady that's letting you do it unfortunately has health issues and family members step in. There's so many things that can happen.
Good point.
in a year, 2 years, especially in 5 years, that can change the whole situation. You know?
Yeah. And at the end of the day, if whoever that nice little old lady happens to pass, then we have to deal with an estate. We have to wait for the estate to be opened. We have all sorts of potential people who go, oh my God, no, I'm not selling this to you, because again, I could get $100,000 more if I were to sell it today. And it's not good.
No, there's so I many. Went with, she went sick. I let the attorney go to gloom and doom with the death of it.
I do have a success story. I have a gentleman who closed on one last year, and the agreed price was like $85,000, and the house appraised for like $145,000. So he won.
So Jay, if let's say hypothetically we get one that's a success, and they structured it that all of my rent payments, I'm buying Steve's house, all of my rent payments go towards the purchase price. And ultimately, when I get to zero, basically owed, that's when it's mine. He's going to give me the deed. We're going to call it a day. I come to you to say, okay, well, now I want to, you know, I don't know, get some cash out, do a cash out refi because I want some money in my pocket. How do I have to wait? Can I walk to you on day two and say, hey, I just got this house. Give me my money.
You probably, unless you were meticulous with your record keeping, it would be hard to prove that. But I mean, technically, if you could prove all those payments, then you probably could immediately do it, dependent upon the loan type, you know. But if worst case would be you take ownership of a property, you would have to wait 6 months. And then after 6 months, you could take an appraisal and take the full allowable amount of cash out.
Okay.
It's a little trickier within 6 months, but it can be done.
Good to know.
Yeah, that's good to know, because I know before we went live, you'd kind of asked that question, I think, before Jay joined us, as far as, or while you're, I think you're actually logging in about that. And I never really thought about that piece, but sometimes, you know, people do, they want to then get that money to go on to another investment. You know, that's more, I'm thinking more of the investment side. Somebody wants to buy a two family. Seller finance, which we talked about before, is more, more prevalent in that part of the industry. Mm-hmm. But if they did do seller financing, then they'd refi, get their own money, and then purchase another one. But
which again, don't love seller financing either.
Bloom and doom, Christy.
I know, but like seller goes, runs away again to Europe and never comes back. And I need a discharge and I can't get it from them. We've paid it off. We're happy, but, and they're paid in full, but I didn't keep great records because, oh, it's okay. And then I have to get that done. And that's another lawsuit. So just like the closer the relationship between the parties, usually the more ways there is to go sideways and other issues that are potentially going to come down the road, right? Like when we're dealing with, I guess, professionals, I use the term loosely, including banks, right? That do this day in, day out. Yes, mistakes happen, right? Especially like banks forget to file discharges sometimes, but that's okay because they have their record that they got paid in full most of the time. I mean, we've had some really old ones where they're like, did it get paid? And we're like, well, that bank hasn't existed in 25 years. So nobody knows. If you're not seeing it on your books and you haven't foreclosed, odds are it's painful. So give us the discharge. But they do what they need to do to fix it. It might take some time, 30, 45 days, but it gets done. Whereas tracking down random seller who knows where to give me their discharge is practically impossible. Really difficult. But anyway, that's a separate.
I was going to say, we'll be sure to have a conversation about that one of these days. Anybody else have anything to add? And thanks for the good news from the buyer standpoint, Jay. I'm not sure how the seller felt about the fact that his house appraised at 140 when he sold it for 80 something. But
he's a man of his word.
And that is nice to hear. Absolutely.
Oh.
Anybody else have anything to add before we call it for the day?
Just that if anyone's listening out there and paying attention and has any questions, they should reach out to us so we can guide them the right way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And again, it's not all gloom and doom, but you want to do your research on both the buyer side and the seller side. And you want to have all parties involved from the beginning to make sure that you're covered.
Yeah. Right. Okay. We try to prevent you from the gloom and doom.
Yes.
The highest level possible of the gloom and doom, you know.
Yeah. From the insurance guy. There he goes. Yes. All right, everybody, have a great day. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you again.
Bye. Bye.